Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Pilates Charisma.
Okay, do you want to go first? Will I go first?
I can go first, but before we do any of that, yeah. I was thinking there are congratulations in order.
A listener
sent us an email, and I didn't talk to her about this, so we should probably give her some modicum of privacy. So we're not going to name this listener, but we had someone send us probably the best email I've ever read when doing this.
I feel like I'm going to keep that in like my back pocket of life, so that on the days where I'm a bit sad or down, I can go, oh, but remember we got that email and it was perhaps the loveliest thing I've ever read.
Yes. That's basically, that's basically exactly it. So just to fill people in, one of our long time listeners and community members who has submitted stuff for word extravaganzas and fired off emails every now and then and comments on Facebook pages and such, sent us an email saying, with the subject heading, the slightly worrying subject heading of, "This is all your fault." And I play an optimist on TV fairly convincingly, I think, but I will admit that when I saw an email in the inbox saying, "This is all your fault," I kind of went,
waiting to be caught out is kind of my default state of existence.
Like, I try to make a conscious choice to replace imposter syndrome with sly con man syndrome, where I kind of try to turn it around. So it's like, I don't belong here, but they don't know that. It's because I'm awesome.
No, I'm full on imposter.
Like, I definitely am. They're going to find me whenever, but it's more of like a...
How long can I get away with this?
I'm constantly starring in my own private Ocean's 11 remake. It's all a scheme.
I haven't seen any of those films, but anyway, onward.
Yeah, Ocean's 57, they kind of ran out of steam, but yeah. Ocean's 11 was great.
I feel a bit like that.
But anyway, so
this
do we
is
do
all
tangents here? Weird. So we got this email saying this is all your fault, but the contents of the email was basically saying that this person had started listening to us and through our show had discovered a bunch of others which were like way smarter than us shows like The Illusionist and some others. And it had basically resulted in her being interested in linguistics in a much more formal way than we could ever provide. And that she was actually going to be starting a master's in linguistics in a place that I have always wanted to just physically visit and be in. Trinity College in Dublin, whose library, if you have not seen it, is your life will be better. And this is a sentence that cannot be said very often. Your life will be improved with a Google image search.
Yes, for sure. In fact, you've probably seen it on a TV show or a film.
Yeah.
At some point in your viewing history and gone, whoa, where is that cool place? That can't be real. It is real. And it's a Trinity. Chinners is for winners. And certainly you are a winner if you are into books and architecture and awesomeness.
Oh, it's just so cool. But yeah, I thought that was amazing.
Just so lovely.
Humbling and lovely and made my day for sure.
And so we are at all times and in all places wishing you, dear listener, all the very best in this endeavour. It sounds like it's going to be completely fantastic. Just so brilliant. And if, you know, Dublin is not that far away from my Fair Isles, if you find yourself in Scotland, let me know.
100%.
Absolutely nerd out about words.
And just thinking about, like, they're not from Ireland. So this is like one of these going abroad and studying things. So it's sort of scratches two itches. And because obviously we only know each other because we made the slightly ridiculous decision to just, hey, you know where we should go is the opposite side of the world.
Very
just
opposite.
To see what happens. And I was only in Korea for like just shy of 2 years, but it has absolutely had a disproportionate impact on my life since then.
Oh, yeah. So much so.
Like everyone I know is sick of stories from Korea.
Yeah. I'm sick of my own stories from Korea, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And yeah, I tell them all the time because, yeah, sometimes I wonder who I was before that.
Mm-hmm. And if I was in any country inhabited by any of the people that I knew like 15 years ago and haven't seen since I left, I would absolutely call them up and be like, we should go for a pint.
Yeah.
And I would feel fairly confident that that would work. And it would just be like, cool, let's do it. So I'm excited for her on the academic front and the fact that she's about to know way more about linguistics than we do.
Oh, so much so.
and also just the personal level and what that experience is going to be, could possibly hold in store. It's just great all over.
Yeah, we are both super duper delighted. Thank you so much for sharing that lovely email with us, and all the very best. Yes. I can't wait to hear how it's going. It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. Super. Okay. Shall we word?
Shall we word? Yes. Okay. So, we just had a conversation about who was going first, and I don't remember what the conclusion of it was. Was there a conclusion?
I don't either. I'll just jump in.
Okay, go for your life.
Because I have a good word that exemplifies how weird it is to try to figure any of this stuff out as far as nailing down dates and whatnot.
I love it.
But we're going to get there. So the word that I've chosen for this week is charisma.
Ooh, what a beautiful word.
It's always been a great word for me. And charisma to me is sort of like, it's a bit like porn to the U.S. Supreme Court. Like, I have trouble nailing down exactly, I know it when I see it, is where I'm going with that, right? Like,
I was not aware that the U.S. Supreme Court had such trouble with pornography. Do you know who doesn't have trouble with pornography? The Tory MP who was caught this week by colleagues watching pornography while in the House of Commons.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
That's a thing. Maybe that's not this week. I'm still a little bit hiding from the world. And so my husband told me about this story. I haven't read it myself. So apologies if any of those facts are incorrect. But there was certainly an MP caught watching pornography in the House of Commons.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he obviously knows it when he sees it.
Yeah.
I don't know the case that was being decided or even indeed the judge that said it, but it was a U.S. Supreme Court decision. It was about, I think it was possibly something to do with Larry Flint, but they were talking about the line between like just nudity in art and pornography. And it has gone down in the history of, well, I mean, I know a quote from a Supreme Court judge in a country in which I do not live. So it tells you kind of where it's at, but I know it when I see it. So that's how I feel about charisma. Like, I'd have trouble sort of defining it because it's kind of a little bit finicky and amorphous, but it's good and you know it when you see it. Characters that draw people into someone, let them kind of not sort of skate through life because that feels like they're intentionally doing it in order to get something, which is sort of a byproduct sometimes, but just a magnetism of personality.
Yeah.
Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, I think so.
So this sense, that's the only sense of this that I knew of before starting this. I don't know if you're from, there is, yeah, well, it comes, yeah, it goes back. But so the first citation from of this sense of charisma dates back to 1930.
Oh.
And so it's fairly recent, and it's kind of like talking about utopia and how Thomas More just sort of, we can pinpoint this word comes from this person.
Sure.
Who introduced it into English in this work, and away we go. So it's kind of like that, because this goes back specifically to Max Weber, okay, the German sociologist, historian, social scientist, writer guy in the early half of the 20th century. And indeed, last portion of the 19th century. So it comes from him, and it's generally linked to his 1922 book, Economy and Society, which is the English title, the German title of which I am not going to attempt.
We're absolute pronunciation cowards. That's the phrase I'm after.
That, yes. Yeah. No, it's true. yeah. It's so, and I know this is terrible audio because it's just me hemming and hawing, but it's hard to nail this down, because in the book Economy and Society, which was published in 1922, he identified and sort of defined the term charisma that we know and use and love today. But it definitely had a more rarefied feel to it. Like charisma was not a thing that as many people had then as they do now in the modern sense of it. Pretty much anyone can have some level of charisma now.
If the book was written in 1922, why is the first citation from 1930?
I was wondering if you would ask that. I mean, I assumed you would ask that. It gets worse.
okay.
If you thought that was strange, the earliest English citation from Economy and Society was from the 1947 translation of Economy and Society.
Okay, that makes sense.
In the OED. The 1930 translation was from a different Weber book where he uses the word and sort of throws it out there, but the 47 translation of the 1922 book is where we get it really explained.
Right.
If that makes any sense. So it's used in context in the same sense, but because we're dealing with a word that is being used and translated and brought in from German to English. So Economy and Society came out in 1922.
Right.
Max Weber died in 1920.
Oh God.
So it was,
you're twisting my melon, man.
I know. So Max Weber wrote another book in 1905.
Okay.
That's the book whose English translation in 1930 gives the OED its first citation of charisma. Then in 1922, Max Weber dies. In 1920, Max Weber dies. In 1922, Economy and Society, which is his like opus, is posthumously published. Then in 47, it gets translated. Or 1930, the earlier book gets translated, including the word charisma. In 1947, Economy and Society gets translated, including the word and an explanation of what he meant by it gets translated. And then from then on, basically from then on, charisma, that's what charisma means.
Okay, got you.
So it was one of those like, this is what we mean when we say it's impossible to know exactly when, even in this case where we know the guy who introduced it.
Yeah.
It still makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah.
To try to figure out exactly when it happened, because it's just so convoluted. And you think we have evidence of this amount of convolution in the introduction of what it takes for a word to come into writing and being and into the dictionary. And
less
we already have more
ago.
Stuff. And it was less than 100 years ago. So then you go, what about these words that it's like, oh, well, this shows up in 1512. Right? Like, so let that nestle into your brain folds a little bit and you get an idea. So somewhere in the first half of the 20th century, charisma kind of calcifies into the current modern sense of it. And it's Max Weber's fault, basically.
Okay.
But the earliest citation for charisma with that spelling and that usage is from the OED. The OED cites it in 1875, but in a slightly modified form of charism, just charisma without the A on the end, that goes back to the 1640s.
What?
And charism was the singular form, the plural form of which was charismata, which is pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's just a fun word to say.
That's better than charisma.
It is. I wish charismata was the one that won out, I think, because it's neat. And this sense is strictly theological. And it means, as the OED writes it, quote, a free gift or favor specially vouchsafed by God, a grace or a talent, end quote.
Oh, that's lovely.
So that's what a charism, or that's what charismata were gifts, favors, a God's freely given graceful gift, something in that ballpark.
Cool.
The earliest form of charisma, that one from 1875, was from Encyclopedia Britannica. And this is the quote. It's about, it says, Schleiermacher was accustomed to say of Bleak that he possessed a special charisma for the science of introduction. And this is one of those, I know all those words by themselves, but but that it gives you the idea of having a special charisma.
Yeah, I like that.
A charisma is...
I like that a lot.
Yeah, not the way we use it now at all.
Because when you were, when you were saying at the start, you know, it's kind of hard to pin down. What I was thinking was, it is hard to pin down because there's no single set of traits that make up charisma. It's different in every charismatic person that you encounter. You can say, oh, so-and-so is really, really charismatic, but I don't know why it is because they're so very different from this other charismatic person. But to kind of... to make it a singular difference, that person has a special talent of some sort that is almost seems God-given. Is much, yeah, I like that. I think it's much clearer almost.
Yeah, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah,
when you have that backstory, and I think the other thing is we don't actually usually say charisma now. We'll say it, but I think more often it's the adjective. If someone is charismatic, you don't talk about them necessarily having charisma. I mean, you do, but I feel like the adjective form is a more common, and it's sort of the default way we think of it. It's a description, not necessarily a concrete thing you could sort of hold in your mind's hand to ruin a metaphor.
An abstract, I believe, is the word you're after.
Hey, you know what? Listen, if the mind can have an eye, the mind can have a hand.
And if the mind can hold a concept in its metaphorical hand, then is not that a concrete...
Exactly. You can see something in your mind's eye.
If we're going to have this kind of conversation, I need beer.
This is the kind of thing that when we eventually hold our completely impromptu and informal word nerd symposium with Mark and Avon and Paul Anthony Jones and stuff in some sort of shady pub in Newcastle, this is the kind of thing we're going to be doing. Like, does the mind have a hand? What about feet?
Does the mind have a hand?
Can you wander down the streets of some foreign city with your mind's feet?
I think you can. So you know, when I teach the concept of abstract and concrete to young minds,
yeah,
almost always I use the Johnny Cash song, That Thing Called Love.
Okay.
A, because I am cheesy, and B, because it's perfect. It's like you can't see it with your eyes, you can't hold it with your hand, but you know what it is. And that's generally, as a beginner, starter place, how I would define an abstract. You know it's
this
there.
This is why you teach people, and
you know
I do not.
You know it's there, but you can't physically touch it, and you may not even be able to give it a physical description. You can give examples of it or examples of its effect, but you do not know what it itself looks like, or it's not a physical thing. Therefore, it's abstract. If you can touch it with your hand, it's concrete. But if you can touch it with a mind's hand, then you've completely blown my definition.
But only with your mind's hand. Anyway, okay, this is, yeah.
The more you say your mind's hand, the more crazy it sounds.
I'm going to lean into this. This is the thing now. That's my new thing.
Well, I believe, you know, as we've said etymology is not an exact science, but I think this is sort of how words get created.
This is the least exact thing I've ever done. Do we do tangents here? So at one point it was possible to have a charisma for a certain thing. Mm. So you could have a charisma for teaching. You could have a charisma for public speaking, a charisma for math, you know, like it was just a special ability. And that was sort of the watered down form of this like literally miraculous special ability.
Nice.
Which is where it first comes in, because the earliest and most common use of charism would have been, it was in the book of Acts in the Bible, mm-hmm. for the origins of Pentecost.
Oh, nice.
And very briefly, the disciples were gathered together. There was there's said to be celebrating a specific Jewish festival, which I do not remember the name of, apologies, but they're gathered together and the Holy Spirit descends upon them, and then they are able to speak to the masses that had gathered outside, and it's in Jerusalem, so very cosmopolitan, multicultural city, and they were able to speak to the assembled masses in their various languages of the assembled masses. Kind of like a reversed and helpful Tower of Babel story.
Yeah.
And so that was the level of specialness that charisma in its earliest forms had. So you were like unto the apostles. That's how good at math you are.
Nice.
Right? So this is absolutely one of those cases where it weakens over time and gets kind of diluted and democratized and everyone gets a piece. And originally that's where it was from. And etymologically, it comes from Latin, and before Latin, it came from Greek, charisma, charisma. And the Greek meaning was favor or divine gift, from charis, meaning grace or beauty or kindness. And it's related to another word in Greek that means to rejoice at, or sort of cousins. And so one of Aphrodite's three attendants was named Charis.
I was going to say, I know people called Charis. I didn't realize that the name was directly a Greek word meaning beautiful things.
Yeah, stick an MA on the end of their name and they are Charisma, and it doesn't really change the meaning of their name at all. And it ultimately comes from a Proto-Indo-European root meaning to like or want. So it started as, I like that, to, you are literally a gift from God, to, you're good at parties. And that's the that's the arc of charisma over the millennia.
You know, we took a little holiday a few weeks ago, and we took a little holiday in Scotland. We drove for 2 hours and stayed in a hotel and pretended we were tourists in our own country. And,
nice.
You know, we were led to do this originally by the pandemic, and I highly recommend it. It's good fun.
Oh,
we
yeah.
went to places that we would never have gone to, because usually you just don't become a tourist in your own land. And one of the places we went to was the National Museum of Flight, which was super cool, because I would not have gone to the National Museum of Flight, but my sister recommended it. She had been there and on a similar let's be tourists in our own country trip, and she said, you should go, it's really cool. And I didn't really know what I was expecting, but she said, it's really awesome, you should go. And what you do is you go in, it's on an old RAF base. So there's like a sort of security booth to drive in. And they give you directions to go to the kind of visitor centre area where the toilets and the cafe and things are. You buy your ticket and then they say, okay, go to that building first. And in that large building, there's a Concorde.
Oh, like a, really?
Yeah. Like, I was not expecting that. Like, holy shit, that's a Concorde. Right there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, and you know, there was a little exhibition about Concorde and its history and supersonic flight and how it was decommissioned and the crash and all that stuff. And then you get to go upstairs and have a little look around the Concorde and look at all the switches in the cockpit. And it was super cool. And there were, you know, they have, because it's such a big physical space. You know, they have aircraft hangars and they are filled with all sorts of aircraft. And it was really interesting. I can only imagine if you're actually like a proper aircraft nerd, then all your dreams have come true at that place.
Yeah.
I would consider myself somebody who might occasionally go, yeah, planes are pretty cool. And I loved it. So if that was really properly your thing, yeah, like, you know, Nirvana. But one of the kind of exhibits was, it was about the sort of planes that they used in like the 60s and the 70s. And the interviews with the stewards and the stewardesses and the pilots and what it was like and the life that they lived and, you know, and the terms and conditions, all the sort of stuff that they experienced. And I basically found myself thinking, the past was just so much better, you know? And like, we've discussed at length how we're quite glad that we don't live in history.
Yeah.
Because there were so many ways to die young and horribly.
But the past was objectively garbage,
yeah,
in a big picture sense.
But the sort of, the kind of near past, like the early 20th century past, what we were discussing, my husband and I, we were thinking about how, like, for example, look at Concorde. Excess, luxury, celebrity yeah, lifestyle, jet set, you know. And these days, we're sort of bombarded with that kind of thing. Whereas back in the 60s, it was a sort of a rarefied, special charisma kind of thing.
Yeah.
And now you're like, well, anyone with a camera and some lights can, you know, become a star. And it's sort of, it's been democratized, which in one sense is a great thing, but in another yeah, sense, it just makes, like, the fact that you could have bespoke porcelain on a flight and silverware designed by, you know, Terence Conran or whatever. And
yeah,
I know that, you know, nostalgia is a dangerous game, but yeah, looking back on the time when being an air stewardess was like going to parties and being invited to embassies and hanging out with film stars, you know, whereas now I feel like if you're an air steward on a budget airline, you work fucking hard, you know?
Yeah.
And you probably don't get paid as much money as you should for what you do. And the hours are long and it's physically demanding, it's emotionally demanding. And, you know, things just seem more fun in the 50s and 60s is what I'm saying.
You do all that stuff just to get made fun of by the Foo Fighters in an amazing music video.
Exactly.
yeah, I don't, like, I feel like there's layers to it, especially with sort of recent past stuff, because on the one hand, they're often examples of things that are what I like to call needlessly beautiful.
Yes.
Like there's a water treatment plant in the east end of Toronto.
Okay.
That is like, it's a water treatment plant. A water treatment plant does not need to be beautiful. It is possibly the most utilitarian thing I can think of. This water treatment plant is objectively gorgeous. Like,
see,
for no reason.
I love that.
Yeah, there's no reason for it. There's no reason for there to be Art Deco accents and fountains outside and this beautiful stone,
just gorgeous
building mounted atop like this sort of bluff that looks out over Lake Ontario. Like, it is just, it's a beautiful place to be. Why do I want to go walk around the grounds of a water treatment facility?
Well, quite simply because someone bothered to make it beautiful.
That's exactly it. And like Harvard was the same way when we were there. We were commenting on that all the time. Like,
yeah,
that's a cemetery wall. Why is it gorgeous?
Yeah.
What, like that kind of thing. So element of that, I think.
It just kind of feels like everything. Now, you know, I know there were poor people in the past too. I'm not an idiot. But, you know, I look at, like, I live in an area of Dundee where there are quite a lot of fairly old buildings, fairly old houses. And you look at the construction of these old houses and you think, why did we stop building houses that look like that? And the simple answer is because it costs a lot of money to do that. And other cheaper, faster ways were found. whereby you didn't need a stonemason to come, and you know, it was less expensive, and it, but also they don't look as nice, you know.
Yeah,
just things. Yeah. Things did get cheaper, and they got more available, and they got more convenient, and all of those things are good things, but also, yeah, the idea that something could be needlessly beautiful. Just, I wish that needless beauty was available to everyone, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's not the world okay. that we live in, but I wish that it was accessible and affordable for someone to say, you know what, I would like my shed to be really beautiful for yeah. no reason other than that I'd like to look at it every day and feel that little glow of happiness.
Yeah, pretty things are nice to look at.
And so I'm a bit disappointed that charisma has been diluted and watered down into good at parties. I mean, I love people who are good at parties, but yeah. you know what I'm saying.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, charisma.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I do love ata ending Greek derived words.
Yeah.
There's a textbook of rhetoric called the Progymnasmata. And
that's so cool.
It's so cool. And I love it because I'm highly pretentious and learning about rhetoric is entirely my jam. But it's the gymna bit. You remember Andy Hallenbeck talked about this.
Yeah.
Basically, it means exercises. So these are exercises for rhetoric. And it takes yeah. you through how to use all the various different figures and techniques. And I love it. But the word is so satisfying to say.
It really is.
And if you're not thinking about stigmata at this point, then
yeah.
like, what's in your head? And if that's not a super cool word, then what are you even doing here?
Yeah. Gymnasmata. Yeah, that's charisma. So cool.
Charismata.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. So I find myself in the unusual position of sort of having a choice about which word I talk about next, which I suppose means that I could engineer the title of the episode, which is something that we try not to do. So purely for that reason, for my own ridiculous rule that we kind of made up accidentally, I'm going to stick with my original word, even though there are valid reasons why I could have talked about the other one off the heels of what you said about charisma.
That's, woman's got to have a code.
Yeah, exactly. What are we without a code? Just meaningless beasts. And in fact, you sort of accidentally inspired me to research this word and to think about this word, because the word that I'm going to talk about today is Pilates.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So yeah, this is a dear reader. So I used to be a yoga teacher, and currently I'm training to be a Pilates teacher for lots and lots of reasons. The main one being because I wanted to, but other complicated things have arisen in my life whereby I don't teach yoga anymore, but I'm very much looking forward to teaching Pilates. However, Ryan and I had a small exchange where I was at training last weekend. We couldn't record an episode, and we had a little exchange about Pilates, and I thought, you know, this is actually a surprising number of people have this reaction when I talk about this. So maybe the listeners of this podcast, maybe they might enjoy it too. And Pilates, people are often surprised to discover, is an eponym. And you remember when we first talked about eponyms on this podcast, don't you? The first eponym I recall discussing was one Mark Pancake.
I love Mark Pancake.
Good old Mark Pancake. Because an eponym is, according to Wikipedia, a person, place or thing after whom or which someone or something is or is believed to be named. And, you know, there are literally thousands of eponyms in the English language. Some of my favourites, jacuzzi, just because the Jacuzzi brothers sound like they'd be awesome fun.
Yeah.
And Biro, of course, the pen after Laszlo Biro. And Pilates, the method of exercises compiled and created by Joseph Hubertus Pilates. And people crack up when you tell them that Joe Pilates is a person.
it's because Joe Pilates, like, that's what they would call it if they were jokingly making up. Like, Joe Pancake would have been probably the default like, oh yeah, sure. Thanks a lot, Joe Pancake.
Yeah. So
get a little Joe Pilates over here.
So this is exactly what people in my life do, which has led to Simon Yoga being suggested as another one, and Kevin Zumba, and other such. I think my favorite was one of my friends said, "What, like Colin Jazzercise?"
Colin Jazzercise. Ike and I had a thing. We were playing chess on a little travel chess keyboard when we were playing in shows. Speaking of old stories from Korea, we were on the KTX to go someplace else to play something. Ike and I were playing chess, and somebody bumped one of us, and the chessboard kind of was rattled. But because it's a travel chessboard, all the pieces were magnetic. And I just went, thank you, Joseph Magnetism, for inventing magnets. And so from then on, in my head, Joseph Magnetism was the inventor of magnets and magnetism in general.
Makes perfect sense. Well, in fact, Joseph Pilates is the inventor of Pilates.
Fantastic.
This is interesting because he never referred to his method by the name Pilates. He didn't. He called it the method. In fact, he called it, and this was what Ryan and I were talking about, he called it Contrology.
It's so good.
It's so good. It's a lovely name. And he published a book, Return to Life Through Contrology, is the sort of seminal Pilates text, if you're interested in the method. And he was a really interesting man, Joseph Pilates. He was born in Mönchengladbach in Germany, which is a fairly small, fairly obscure sort of place. And he travelled to Britain, and World War I was breaking out. And because he was an enemy alien, he was interned at Nokolo internment camp on the Isle of Man.
Right.
And this was pretty crappy, of course, pretty terrible. However, he looked back upon this period in his life with, bizarrely, some fondness, because he said that it gave him some time. It gave him plenty of time to work on his method. Now, what he called his method, he compiled 34 exercises, bodyweight exercises that can be done on a mat without any special equipment. And these exercises, the classical 34 exercises, are intended to be an expression of what a healthy body can do. So if you have a healthy musculoskeletal system without any injuries or restrictions, you should be able to do all 34 of Joe's exercises. Now,
yeah,
I take a moment to just in case you're ready to jump in your car, drive to your nearest Pilates studio and throw yourself into a mat class, it might not work out so well for you like that, because Joe came from a time when people worked harder physically, for the most part, you know, in terms of their daily lives. People moved more. The manual labor was more of a thing for more people, and life was not as physically easy as it is in lots of ways. So Pilates wanted the whole world to practice his method. He wanted everybody to have this healthy body, healthy mind. He was very kind of, you know, he thought that the two were inextricably linked. And so when the war was finished, he eventually, he found his way to New York. He married, his wife was called Clara, and they began teaching his method in a little studio very close to lots and lots of dance schools, which turned out to be a pretty useful setup for him. He taught a lot of dancers. But he never ever said, come and do Pilates with me. It would be a bit like saying, come and do my exercises.
Yeah.
So he called it Contrology. And he discovered quite quickly that lots of people couldn't do these exercises, these 34 classical mat exercises. People who were injured, people who just hadn't led the sort of life that led them to have a healthy spine. And so he then began inventing, with the help of his brother Fred, another hilariously generic name.
Oh, Fred Pilates.
So Joe and Fred created several Pilates apparatus. There's tons of apparatus. The Universal Reformer, which has that same sort of twinge of Soviet nostalgia about it that Contrology has, I always think.
So also, I mean, the elephant in the room here is that all Pilates equipment anywhere ever looks like it was devised by the most sadistically creative torture chamber grand wizard ever. So
yeah.
You walk into a room and see a Pilates apparatus and then find out that like it's called, what was it you called it? The Great Reformer?
Universal like, Reformer.
Nope. Universal Reformer. Yeah. Nope. I'm out. Goodbye. I'd like to introduce you to the Universal Reformer now. No, you will not.
Yeah, so in January, I took delivery of a fairly hefty piece of Pilates apparatus. It dominates my spare bedroom. And a good, I mean, I was about to say two-thirds, but we're talking more 80 to 90% of the people who have been in that room since then have come in and gone, is this some sort of sex thing?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, dude, it is not.
Other initial first impression.
So, I mean, it is fair to point out, and it was the basis of a pretty solid joke in the latest Spider-Man film, that, yeah, Pilates apparatus is quite daunting when you see it for the first time.
You walk into a room with one of those, and you know immediately and instinctively you are either about to have a really good or really bad time.
Well, the apparatus is designed to help you to access the mat exercises. That's basically how it goes. But it uses... Joe was hugely ingenious, and he made use of springs and resistance and shapes. There's another piece of apparatus called the Spine Corrector. I'm aware it sounds just as sinister as the Universal Reformer.
It sure does.
And then the Cadillac, which... I like this one a lot. My friend whose parents are immigrants to the US, she is also a Pilates teacher, and she says it's such a brilliant example of the kind of immigrant take on the American dream. So the piece of apparatus that he considered to have all the bells and whistles is called the Cadillac.
Nice.
Because that's, you know, in America, that's how you know you've made it. You've got a Cadillac. It's the fanciest, most swish thing that there is. So Joe's Cadillac... I quite like the naming of that. Anyway, etymologically speaking, rather than just talking about Pilates, which you probably guessed is something that I can do for quite a long time in quite a lot of detail. So the first written citation of this is from 1930, again. However, I don't think I've ever seen this before as a citation in the OED. It's from the Manhattan Classified Telephone Directory.
Sorry,
and,
what?
So it refers to Pilates Universal Gymnasium, the listing in the phone book for Joe's studio.
That is, there cannot be many citations in the OED from phone books.
You wouldn't imagine so. No, I really, I like that a lot.
And, that's so cool.
And then quite a few of the other citations actually come from Joe. There aren't tons given in the OED. There's only six. The next one is from Joe. He wrote a book called Your Health, or perhaps an article. Normal anatomical balance in every position taken is only possible in the Pilates health bed. Now, if you want to capture a little bit of what Ryan is talking about of that, this is surely an implement of torture. Have a little Google of the Pilates health bed. Joe slept on one. His wife slept on one. Apparently, they were very comfortable. I haven't ever seen one other than in the pictures of Joe's, Joe's own self-built examples of these. But there will be some collector out there or some enthusiast out there who's sleeping in a Pilates bed. Then we get a citation from Return to Life Through Contrology. As I said, Joe's book. And then one from a dance magazine. This is also a hilarious citation. I don't know who it's about. I don't know if it refers to Joe himself, but it says he has a Pilates bednasium in his dressing room for rest and exercise between shows. I don't know if I want to look too hard at the word bednasium, but I do like it.
Bednasium? That... What? How is this the first time? I'm 40 years old. How is this the first time ever hearing the word bednasium?
Bednasium. Well, there you go. You're welcome. And then 1977, we have many of the company's dancers followed the Pilates system. And then from 1999, The trend for softer, slower, stretch-based exercise classes that focus on body awareness will continue to grow, with more yoga, ballet, Feldenkrais and Pilates classes available nationwide. So, yeah, the Pilates system of exercises, it's a very, it's a very straightforward etymology in contrast with charisma. The guy was called Joe Pilates, and thus his exercises are called Pilates. Interestingly, there was a, now I'm not any great expert on this particular case, but when Pilates began to kind of grow in popularity, there was a fairly famous court case in the US because a group of teachers wanted to trademark the name Pilates. And if they had been able to do that, then, you know, basically they would have controlled the brand. They would have controlled how it's taught, how it's practiced, how studios operate, all of that stuff. It would have been big business. Yeah. But it was ruled that Pilates was a generic name for these systems of exercise. And so it could not be trademarked. And, so there's no little TMR symbol after the name. And legally in the US, certainly it's not possible for that to happen.
Of course, that also ruled out in advance any of the automatically clever and hilarious ways of describing Pilates. Like if it's only Pilates if it's in a studio owned by this corporation, otherwise it's just sparkling pain and flexibility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly that. And so anyway, I've gotten myself off track, which is, again, so much not like me. But it got me thinking about eponyms again, this word. And, you know, we've discussed eponyms in the past, but I came across one fairly recently that led me down an interesting little word-based rabbit hole. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but when new babies are born, they are given an Apgar score. Have you heard of this?
Yep.
So the Apgar score, APGAR, it's done between 1 and 5 minutes after birth. And it's like a quick evaluation of how healthy that brand new baby is.
Yeah.
However, Apgar is an eponym.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was created by Dr. Virginia Apgar in 1952.
I think I assumed it was a... I think this is when I assumed was an acronym.
This is what's so beautiful about it. It is, in fact, a backronym.
Neat. Oh, so, that is cool.
Here's, and again, I'm Wikipediaing here. Dr. Apgar originally thought up the criteria as a way to address the lack of a standardized way to assess the need for assistive breathing procedures for newborns. She presented it in 1952 to a meeting of the International Anesthesia Research Society and the International College of Anesthetists, and it was published in 1953. The Apgar score itself, the criteria are appearance. So if the baby is blue or pale all over, it gets a zero. Yep. If it is blue at the extremities or pink in the body, it's a one. If there's no cyanosis in the body, it's pink, it gets a two. The next one is pulse rate. So again, absent, less than 100 beats per minute, more than 100 beats per minute. Then there's grimace. Does the baby make faces and respond to any sort of stimulation? There is also activity, is the baby moving? And lastly, the respiratory effort. So I like this a lot.
Grimace is definitely where the acronym was forced, I feel.
Sorry?
I feel like grimace is the point at which that acronym became forced. Like,
well, possibly.
The rest of them fit really well.
But babies do grimace.
They are aliens from a raisin planet, is what they are. their entire body grimaces. There's no question about that. It's absolutely true.
So,
just objective fact.
For that reason, I feel like grimace is kind of all
that's
right.
Fair. Okay.
But yeah, so some 10 years after the initial publication, a backronym for Apgar was coined as a mnemonic learning aid. So appearance, pulse, grimace, activity and respiration. And it also works in several different languages. It's given here in Spanish and French and Czech and all these different places. So okay.
Can I ask a question about
the
backronym thing? Do we know, was it Dr. Apgar that assigned it acronymic status? Or
I don't know that.
Because my first, like, first of all, I want to pause and just reflect on the reality of what was going on and the ovarian fortitude of a woman in the early 50s presenting to a college of, like, American College of Anesthesiologists. Like, the fact, I'm shocked that there was, someone was, a woman was allowed, quote unquote, to, you know, like, the hostility in that room must have been intense.
Quote unquote. I don't know a great deal about Dr. Virginia Apgar, but she, every picture that I've ever seen of her says to me, this is a formidable woman.
Yeah, and, well, I feel like you'd have to be.
You're quite correct. There were not tons and tons of obstetric anesthesiologists who were women at that time. I certainly wouldn't imagine.
So my cynical thought on the acronym was, I wonder if this was an attempt to not have this woman's name tied to it. Oh, it's not named after the woman. It's named after the features of the test. You know what I mean? Like, which is very cynical of me, but I live in the world, so.
I don't know. I don't know about that. Now, I should point out also, I really hate the word backronym.
Yes.
It's offensive to me for some reason. But I do like the concept of a backronym, although sometimes they're so obnoxious, it's just, you know, it's not even true. And here are some of them. This was my rabbit hole. I found myself backronymed up, and
okay.
And so I did a little bit of investigating into some backronyms, and here's one that I was so totally taken aback by this. Because I always assumed that an amber alert was an amber alert because of red, amber, green.
Yeah.
But it's not. The United States Department of Justice's Amber Alert program was named after Amber Hagerman, a 9-year-old who was abducted and murdered in 1996.
I did not know that.
I did not know that either. However, It was later publicized as a backronym, America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response. Now,
interesting.
A lot of these faintly hilarious backronyms are, some of them are from American legislation, which I really am quite, some of them are hilarious, I think it's fair to say. And yeah, I'll take you through some of these. They're pretty excellent.
Okay.
Oh, she says, immediately losing the thing that she was trying to see. Hold on a second. But the Amber Alert thing really, I just was not expecting that.
Yeah. So I wonder if, while you're looking for that, I wonder if there's a difference between, because in my mind, like, a backronym, and yeah, the more I say it, the less I like the word.
Yeah, it's awful, isn't it?
It's sort of more specific than just someone who has sort of retconned an acronym into a word. It's more like it doesn't actually exist, but it was presented as though it's the actual etymology, like that stupid, like, I don't know, people officially licensed to investigate crime E for police. I don't know what the E was supposed to be for, I forget, but it's like, but it's because none of it makes sense.
So, well,
those
well,
kind of things where, like, people just sort of say, thing, oh, that's...
If that sort of thing offends you, you better strap in. Because I found an article from The Independent that looked at 10 backronyms. And I'd say these range from hilarious to nadir of human existence.
Was
personally.
It written by Trent Crim?
It's
literally
not
the only thing
Trent
I think
Crim,
of whenever I hear anyone reference The Independent, and it's a testament to Ted Lasso's immense hold on my life, because I can
good
never hear the word The Independent without hearing in my head it retconned to include Trent Crim before The Independent. Anyway, sorry, go on.
So we've got START, Strategic Arms Reduction Talks.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's not awful, but okay.
And then from the Bond universe, we have Spectre.
Yep.
Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge and Extortion. And I suppose if it points out, you know, you could reverse the last two for the American market.
Sure.
I think this is a largely debunked etymology, but POSH is sometimes given as an acronym, and I think it definitely fits in the category of backronym. So it's not an acronym for port out, starboard home, which was considered the way that the rich people went to India. If you go out on the port side of the boat, if you go out on the port side, then you'll see all the sights from the ship. And if you reverse it and go home on the starboard side, you'll see them again on the journey home. That's the idea.
Oh, okay.
We then have cabal, which is an old word for a secret group derived from Hebrew Kabbalah, but applied to Charles II's ministers, Clifford Arlington, Buckingham, Ashley and Lauderdale. So I thought that one was quite interesting. Then this one is awful. COBRA.
Okay.
This is a British, it stands for Cabinet Office Briefing Room A. COBRA meetings were held at the start of the COVID crisis, for example, most of which Boris Johnson didn't bother his backside to go to because, you know, what's important about that? But it points out in the article.
You laughed at me putting the letter E on the end of my acronym for police.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all they did there.
There's no briefing room B, but it sounds better than COBRA. So it became COBRA. Yeah.
COBRA, right.
We also have Action on Smoking and Health, ASH, the anti-smoking campaign group.
Right.
My favourite of the list is GROSS, Get Rid of Slimy Girls.
Oh, Slimy Girls, yeah. Good old Calvin.
And this one's the top of the list, and it's the one that most makes me want to put my fingers down my throat and do that fake thing.
Yeah.
And it's the USA Patriot Act. Strap in. Uniting and strengthening America, USA, by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. Act. That's not how laws should be made.
The Patriot Act, as a name and as a piece of legislation, was nauseating enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Already. I didn't need to know that it was also a fascist acronym, a fascronym, fascistronym,
subacronym, who knows?
Fascronym? I hate it.
Yeah, I hate it too. I actually, the ones that I referred to on that list, they were numbered 1 to 10, and the USA Patriot Act was 1. But I left it to last because it's definitely the worst. But I buffered it with GROSS because GROSS is my favourite one on the list, obviously.
It's the best. Oh, yeah. It's the best one that's ever been.
Get Rid of Slimy Girls. With a capital S at the end of girls, of course. If you were wondering how that works.
Yeah.
So, yes, Pilates, an eponym that led me to a backronym that's taken up pretty much all of my time and attention just now. And if you've never tried Pilates and you're wondering what it's all about, go and try it. If your back hurts, go and try it even sooner. It's wonderful.
Cool. That's, yeah. I do love an eponym.
Yeah, me too.
I love a surprise eponym.
And I mean,
I think
Guy
is my favourite, but...
If his name had been Mr. Contrology, I would have had questions.
That's true. Now there is nominative determinism for you.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.